Welcome back to Dakota Midday from South Dakota Public Broadcasting. I'm Carl Gerke. The U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum in Washington, D.C. has millions of documents, and for students researching Nazi Germany and the Holocaust, it's easy to get lost. USD Associate Professor of History David Burrow teaches a course on the Holocaust, and he was at the museum last week for a pilot program that's designed to help students access the abundant archives online. Burrow was invited by the museum to apply for the workshop, Teaching the Holocaust Digitally, a Source Study Approach. Burrow is with us here in the studio. And Dave, welcome back to Dakota Midday.
Thanks, Carl. Thanks for asking me.
And why do you think you were invited to apply for this workshop last week?
Well, all of the eight participants were asking why we were invited, and we're not entirely sure. Obviously, we must have done something right. Everybody who was there had been in a faculty seminar, sometimes more. I'd been to two previous faculty seminars, so we must have done something good to impress the staff there in our previous visits. But they were also looking for geographic range, so there were eight people sort of evenly distributed from around the country. So the other representative from the Great Plains was Kurt Borchert, who is a sociologist at the University of Nebraska-Kearney. So we held up the Great Plains, the middle of the – we anchored the middle of the country represented at the workshop.
And what happened at this workshop? Was it a situation where people at the museum were working with you, or was it more of a thing where they were imparting information to you? How did that work?
Well, it really was a workshop. We were given access to this pilot module, this online digital resource before we went, and we were encouraged to look at it and to familiarize ourselves with it. We were all also there on the assumption that we had the content knowledge so that we wouldn't get lost with the facts, but we'd be able to run with the material rather than have to learn it. And then there was a brief introduction on the first day by the two scholars, Dr. Wolfson and Dr. Karen Yee, who ran the workshop. And then we spent most of the first day coming up with questions and coming up with ways to approach the material that's in the module so that we could design assignments for our students. So we were there to do a test run of this pilot project, to both play with it to see what was possible, to break it to find out what sort of things they would need to change, and to find out what its possibilities were. We did hear from we had a visit from Jeff McClurkin, who was a digital humanities scholar at the College of Mary Washington in Baltimore, or in Maryland. Who gave us some materials on the possibilities of a digital humanities scholarship and things that you can do, digital humanities history projects you can do with your students, sort of as models for things we might think about. We met with some program officers from the National Endowment of the Humanities, and we met with some of the museum's archivists and other people. So the faculty and the staff at the museum were very much working with us to help us figure out the materials. But most of our time was hands-on. Most of our time was brainstorming ideas and trying to get different pieces of digital technology to work and then doing presentations at the very end to show off or not show off what we had done.
So this was they created a digital system, or I think you used the word modules, that then your students here at the University of South Dakota can access? Or how was this supposed to work?
Well, it's a work in progress. So we were the first unveiling of this digital module, and we are because in part they didn't know exactly what, you know, faculty who have to teach courses on the Holocaust will be able to do with it. And so we have a site now where we will be throughout the rest of the summer and into the fall posting material and posting suggestions, and they'll be making changes. So by the time I roll it out for my course in the spring of 2015, and most of the other faculty are teaching courses in spring of 2015, it'll probably look a little bit different than the one that we rolled out. But what it started out as is it's a repository for documents, some of which the museum doesn't have on its doesn't have readily accessible otherwise. So one component of the module was a series of diaries, most of which were translated by Dr. Karen Yee. You could get these diaries, you could find them on the museum's archives pages, or you could find them in the museum's website, but they're not translated. So if you don't read Serbian, or you don't read Polish, or you don't read Yiddish, that's not going to, it's not going to help you in a classroom setting. So we had his translations of these diaries, as well as images of the original documents, as well as the documents' metadata. So how the museum got them, what part of the collection they are, how you can look them up in the museum's regular archival material, so that you could have students do a more, you can use these as examples to have students do more in-depth exploration of materials that the museum does hold. So the diaries were one component, and the other component was testimony, post-war testimony of survivors, and that was grouped in chronologically, but that also included some audio interviews that the museum has, edited video testimony, and a variety of other different things.
Well, it sounds like this is part of an effort from the Holocaust Memorial Museum to extend its mission, I guess you would say, or to help students understand the history of the Holocaust.
Right. The museum has over 400 staff. It's a big place. It's divided into several different component parts. So the part that most people see is the exhibition. If you go to the museum itself, if you go to the homepage for the museum, what you see is the exhibition. But that's only part of the museum's overall mission. So the part that I was visiting is called the Center for Advanced Holocaust Studies. And most of what the center has done is have scholarly conferences. It has a whole series of publications. It's in the middle of producing this fantastic series of encyclopedias tracing all of the camps and ghettos where Jews and other victims of the Holocaust were interned or were killed, where POW camps were. It's an immense project. It's taken them. I mean, they're in the middle of, I think, their 10th year of working on it, and they only have the first two volumes published. But they found much more information than anyone thought they would. So it's really, that whole project is really reshaping how scholars see the Holocaust. This is the first effort by the Center for Advanced Holocaust Studies to do something pedagogical, to do something that ties into the scholarly resources that it has available, and ultimately make some of those resources more accessible to people who teach the Holocaust, and make it more accessible to students all across the country.
Now, what was it like for you to be there and to be a part of this pilot program?
Well, it's obviously a great honor to be asked. It's a great honor to be invited to do something at the ground stage of what may eventually be a statewide project. This is my third trip to the museum, so I guess I'm a little bit used to what it's like to work there. They have a series of classrooms on the ground floor, and I know from experience that, you know, the weather in Washington, D.C. is very, very hot, and the classrooms are air-conditioned, very, very cold. So you have the odd sight of the scholars at the museum walking around wearing sweaters where everybody else is sweating, having just come in from the outside. I've met some of the staff before, and some of the other people before. But it was working at the workshop was unlike any other academic experience I've had. I was really interested in this project, in part because of the digital humanities component, which is not something that I have plunged into too much. And so one of the reasons I wanted to be involved with this was because I trusted the museum. I knew that the museum would do a good job setting us up, and this was going to be my first foray into learning how to incorporate more digital humanities tools in my classes here at USD.
And the digital humanities component, this is a way of teaching history and similar subjects online or digitally, or having access to things like the archives or the Holocaust Museum?
Right. More having access and being able to use digital tools for like timeline programs, where you can have students create timelines that then link in pictures and audio and video to have an anchoring timeline that would tell someone's stories, or make an argument about chronology that would be done digitally. It would be on the computer rather than or sort of as a supplement or as a substitute for having them write a traditional paper.
You're listening to Dakota Midday on South Dakota Public Broadcasting. I'm Carl Gerke, and our guest is USD Associate Professor of History David Burrow. He teaches a course on the Holocaust, and he was at the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum in Washington, D.C. last week for a workshop, Teaching the Holocaust Digitally, a Source Study Approach. And Dave, how long have you been teaching the Holocaust here at USD? Your PhD was in, what, Russian history?
Right. My PhD was in Russian history. I replaced, when I was hired here at USD in 2006, I replaced Dr. Don Price, who was a German historian. So I was interviewed on the, I remember during my phone interview for the job, I was asked about teaching a course on the Holocaust, because that was one of Don's more popular classes. And I had had some background in doing that in my previous teaching positions. And so I don't remember what my answer was. It must have worked because they hired me. The museum put out in 2008 put out a call for faculty members who like me, whose degree was not in Holocaust studies, but who taught courses on the Holocaust. And so I've been to two of those faculty seminars that are designed for people in my situation, and both of those have been really helpful in redesigning the course and giving me focused readings. And I think they've both made the class a lot better. So I think the first time I taught the Holocaust course here was in the fall of 2006, and then it's in the rotation every other year in my teaching rotation.
Is there quite a strong interest in this subject among students here at USD?
Yes, there is. It's one of the larger 400 level courses we have. I think it's capped at about 60, and I regularly get between 40 to 50 people enrolled in the class, which is large for USD for the type of course that it is.
Why do you think that is?
Well, I think it's partly because students are fascinated with World War II, and they're fascinated with the fact that the Holocaust, even though it's widely known in the sense that, you know, it's not a hidden historical event, that it's just so hard to understand. It's so the behavior of people during the Holocaust, both the victims and the perpetrators, can be so difficult to comprehend that remains a puzzle. I often hear from students when they tell me why they're interested in the class that they have met a survivor or heard a Holocaust survivor speak in high school. That motivates people to learn more. People may have great grandparents or other relatives who were involved in the conflict or were involved in the Holocaust in some way, and so they're interested in learning more about the context of that family history. And there are people who are interested in it just I think simply because it's such an overwhelming event that you want to be able to grapple with it and be able to process it for yourself.
Do you think do you know what level of understanding or knowledge that the students have of the Holocaust before they come into your class? I know you just mentioned that they know that it happened, that this was a part of history.
It varies quite widely. I have some students who come in who've already had a course on it in high school and who've read about it. I have some students who come in and have only a very basic understanding. I have some students who come in who realize in the course of the semester, and I've had a handful of students tell me this over the years, that they realized that what they knew about it was inaccurate, that they had heard about it from, maybe they had a poor high school teacher or they had somebody who, had an axe to grind about it, and so that they knew inaccurate information. So it varies widely from people who know a fair amount about it and ask very in-depth questions to people who are really learning about it seriously for the first time.
Do you think this is a topic that, as this recedes further and further in the history, that is there a danger, you think, that this might become part of history that is forgotten or maybe less understood as time goes on?
Well, that's certainly one of the things that the museum thinks very, very deeply about. Everybody at the museum knows that eventually all of the survivors will pass away. There are still survivors who teach and speak at the museum who are in their 90s, who are in their 80s. But eventually this will be something that is only understood secondhand. It can't be understood firsthand anymore. And one of the things that the museum, and particularly the Center for Advanced Holocaust Studies, is very self-conscious about is that very fact. That, you know, the one of the things that we talked about in looking at the materials in this module was that when you're reading the diaries and the things that were written firsthand, these are people who don't know that they're in the middle of an event that's later going to be called the Holocaust. They're just in the middle of something horrific happening. There's one of the diaries that we read that's translated is from a 10-year-old Serbian boy named Dura Rajs, who talks about being hungry, about missing his mother, about being transferred into a camp. He'd know sort of what his experience is of life on the ground. He didn't survive, unfortunately, but what his life was on the ground. He doesn't know he's part of some larger thing. It's only afterwards that we can know what this larger thing was and name it and try and define it and try and understand it. So that's our responsibility, is to take the stories that the survivors have left us and take the accounts that the people who lived or did not live through it have left us and make sense of it. So in that sense, I mean, the museum's already engaging in that work, and I think really responsible Holocaust scholars are already engaging in that work right now.
Have you met or spoken with any Holocaust survivors?
I've met several of them at the museum. I've met Margit, I now suddenly can't remember her last name, who's one of their more vocal and more active survivors who gives a lot of tours. Margit Meissner, that's her name. Sure, her autobiography is available at the museum. I've met Philip Gans, who's been to South Dakota several times and Iowa to speak to high school students. He's a survivor of Auschwitz. He was here at USD a couple of years ago to give a talk. So I've met a handful of them.
And what does that meeting them and talking with them? What does that add to your understanding of the Holocaust and the way that you teach this course at USD?
Well, meeting survivors is always, powerful because you want to respect their knowledge and you want to respect the fact that they have chosen to share what is the worst and most traumatic experience of their lives publicly and repeatedly. So they add detail and they add the human emotion that can only come from someone who's, you know, from someone like Philip Gans, who lost his parents and lost his brother and lost his family. It's even if you're reading about someone losing their experiences, the immediacy of how people feel about that is something that you can lose touch with, right? The survivors anchor us in the fact that that these were individual human lives that were affected and that were lost, and that's one of the great challenges of teaching the Holocaust, is conveying individual human lives while still wrestling with the fact that there were so many people who were involved in this.
Are there other challenges in teaching the Holocaust to students?
It's always an emotional challenge for students. I always tell them at the outset of, since my class is taught in the spring, it always starts in January and February. I say, you know, there's going to be some morning where you're going to get up in the morning and you're going to have to come into Dr. Burrow's class at 10 o'clock in the morning and talk about one of the diaries we read, Dawid Sirokoyak, and we're going to talk about Dawid Sirokoyak starving to death. And it's not pleasant to have to do that, you know, in a February in South Dakota. So it can be an emotionally draining experience. It usually is for me, for an emotionally draining experience for the students. That's one of the challenges. There's a great deal of complexity. We're always striving to get the students to be able to talk about things with a higher degree of sophistication. What you consider resistance during the Holocaust? How do you understand what people's behaviors were who were trying to escape and were trying to survive, or people who hid, or people who helped? And so there's a high degree of complexity as well. And if the students are learning the factual material for the first time, it's harder for them to grapple with that kind of complexity. And responsible use. One of the challenges that the museum faces is, of course, that all of their public material, I mean, the museum wants to be open. It wants its archives to be open because they don't have anything to hide. This is a collection of the material. But, of course, that there are people who, out of their own hatreds or out of their own prejudices, are eager to take that material and and distort it in some way. And I've never had that experience with a student here. But, you know, it's always a challenge that if you talk about the Holocaust is that at some point you will inevitably get an email or a message or a post from someone who says, you realize this is all part of a conspiracy and no one really died. And so that's always responsible use and encouraging the students to research, especially if they're doing online research, to research in a way that's responsible and that they know where the material that they're getting is coming from, that they just don't do a quick search and go to the first place they find. Because sometimes the first place they find are anti-Semites who are trying to get their material to the top of a Google search page so that people will find it. So responsible use is another challenge.
And then that's what will happen with when you teach this course again in next spring after going through this pilot program last week at the museum in Washington, D.C., that you'll be able to apply these things then to the course and students will be able to get that firsthand research and investigation.
Yep. They'll be able to delve right in and read some diaries that are translated on that site that aren't available somewhere else and think about them and use them in analysis and see some testimony and some other things that's guided in a way that will help them get to the other resources. As you said in your introduction, the museum's got millions of pages of material. So if you're just looking for things at random, you'll get hopelessly lost. So part of my job using this module is to help guide students in the right places to ask good research questions.
All right. Well, David, thanks so much for taking the time to talk with us on Dakota Midday again.
Well, Carl, thanks for having me back. I appreciate it.
David Burrow is Associate Professor of History at the University of South Dakota here in Vermilion. He teaches a course on the Holocaust and last week attended a workshop on teaching the subject digitally at the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum in Washington, D.C.